The next speaker is Daniel Zerwin. Daniel is the co-founder, CIO, and CEO of Arena Investors. He's going to be speaking private capital, the next bubble, question mark. So my voice should rise at the end of that. The next bubble? Daniel is one of the pioneers in specialty finance. He began his career in 1995. He built D.B. Zerwin to one of the largest independent firms in the alternative credit space. He has participated in over 2,000 illiquid investments, accounting for over $10 billion. Please help me welcome Daniel Zerwin.
I was.
Yeah, and he was in the gym this morning when I was there eating up a treadmill or, no, a stair climber.
That's right. That's right. No choice, unfortunately, at this age. Well, thanks very much for having me, and thank you for the kind introduction. First off, I think I have to admit to resembling some of the comments from that last panel. I'll have to apologize up front for having done well in high school and gone to Harvard Business School. But nevertheless, despite that, those issues, we try to find a way to make money. I thought I would just walk you through the world of private credit and break what I'm going to say down into a few different pieces, and then at the end ask for whether there are any questions. First, I want to talk about whether there is a bubble in private credit. Then, you know, what could cause it. Then, how perhaps people might think about optimizing broader investor portfolios in the context of that of those possibilities. Then we're going to walk through some of the key risks to keep in mind within the kind of private credit world generally, and then we'll go through some of the short and medium term opportunities that we're seeing on a day in day out basis. Hopefully, this will be reasonably comprehensive. First, to start, whether there's a bubble or not. I don't know how there's not. We have an incredible amount of private equity capital, an incredible amount of credit capital, an incredible amount of real estate capital, an incredible amount of just about every type of capital. It's been 9 years since we went through the kind of pain of the 08 crisis, and there are many different sectors and asset classes that have never fully kind of recovered from that. And there are many that from which people took the wrong lessons in terms of certain asset subclasses having done relatively well during that time, and those have accessed capital in ways they shouldn't and in amounts they shouldn't. We also have ratings agencies that have risen subsequent to the crisis, where all kinds of clever folks are playing all kinds of games around arbitraging the ratings that we can get from the secondary agencies. Given that S&P and Moody's and Fitch no longer rate anybody for whom there's a question about their credit quality, there's a whole new group of guys who will do it, and will do it for a fee. Banks are definitely out of the lending business. However, they have invested tremendously in credit-related securities in order to kind of build their portfolios while explaining to the regulators why they're being highly conservative in their lending books, while at the same time explaining to their stakeholders and owners why they're still going to be able to get an appropriate return on equity. It's a tough road to tread. Yeah, I'll walk through, and then I'll go for questions, and we'll walk through. We'll go from there. In private credit, generally, we see connections to the liquid trading markets. So liquid trading markets across corporate, ABS, mortgages, emerging markets, et cetera, have basically are at tighter levels than they have ever been, certainly in the last 25 years, and only the more so because the underlying collateral quality or the deterioration in it is being masked in a variety of ways. And the downside associated with that credit is all the greater because in the wake of the crisis, the OTC markets, the over-the-counter market-making capabilities of the markets have been obliterated. There is nobody making a market. That's a problem when people move toward those liquid, those nominally liquid credit markets on the notion, based on the notion that at some point when they want to get out, there'll be a bid there. And there will be, as long as they don't need it. And so when you take that as your base and then say, well, here's this whole group of quote-unquote private credit markets that should be priced for quote-unquote illiquidity at some sort of premium to what is found in the liquid markets, the entire premise makes no sense because the liquid markets themselves don't have the liquidity that people presume them to have. On top of all of that, I would also point out that we are seeing, and it's purely anecdotal, of course, but day in, day out, the kind of proverbial shoeshine boy, like, you know, picking his favorite stock data points that, you know, people talked about during the 1920s. The level of excess across different asset classes within the credit markets, again, has peaked relative to the last 25 years, as far as I can tell, thinking about 94, 98, 01, 02, 07, 08, et cetera. What can cause the bubble? Certainly, there are no shortage of candidates, whether it's geopolitical, a large-scale fraud, issues within the fundamental structure of the ETF market, a step function drop in a particular collateral type's performance. Any or all of those could be the thing. And as soon as it comes, the day after, we'll all say, I can't believe we missed it. Can't believe we didn't think of it. Residential mortgages were absurdly overpriced in 07. But so were many other things. The notion that that happened to be the place where the fire started, it could have been many others. So how do you optimize investor portfolios? You know, I sit on the investment committees of two boards on which I sit, the Brookings Institution and Barnard College of Columbia. We look at this ourselves, and we look across the different asset classes we're examining. We're looking at rate of return expectations. We're looking at a fixed set of obligations to meet every year in terms of operating these nonprofits. It's not easy. It's not easy at all. We were in a room with some of the top university endowment folks who basically said, pointed out, here are the best three or four or five large scale, fully funded, all the resources in the world, access to credit, university endowments. Here's the returns they've made, taking all kinds of bottom dollar equity risk, all kinds of beta correlation. Here it is. It's going to be great. 8%. It's tough. I think certainly in the very near term, what can you do? You can certainly recognize that in the fixed income markets, you know, regular way fixed income and investment grade is no better than cash, and potentially worse insofar as you're short a series of potential puts. You can certainly look to trim what are basically found money gains. Driven by flows in equity markets, many of which are driven by effectively a dividend yield comparison to what's going on in the nonsensical fixed income markets. And you could certainly look at your corporate and real estate private equity and say, am I getting paid to take on illiquidity in markets that do theoretically have a variety of low-cost indices that recreate that exposure? Am I getting an appropriate premium? In many, many, many cases, I'm not sure you are, whether those are hedge funds or private equity funds or real estate funds, et cetera. So certainly now people come to private credit. When I started doing this, there were only two other firms that I could know, that I knew of, at least in the alternative space, that were doing special situation, you know, private lending. At the time in the 90s, it was Cerberus and Citadel. The fact that private credit has become a quote-unquote defined term in the alternative space should in and of itself be cause for alarm. Once things become a thing that everybody does, you know, we pause and we get concerned. But certainly, as a general matter, it looks relatively good relative to the very low bar present in virtually every other conceivable asset class that's out there. What are the risks? Well, lending is the world's second oldest business. So there's a lot of history to look at. And it can get bad, very bad. And it can be bad on a bank's balance sheet, on an insurance company's balance sheet, off those balance sheets, in the securitization market. All different kinds of ways it can get bad, it gets bad. You can assume tremendous amounts of beta. And you're never ever going to be bailed out by something that makes four times your money, because you need a, you know, you need a 980 batting average to make it all work. So what does that mean? Well, what is the fundamental reason that credit investments blow up? If you look at all those different instances where there were explosions, I think it's the disconnection between the assumption of credit risk and the assumption of the consequences for taking that risk. Of course, we can look back to the residential mortgage crisis, which, by the way, we're near Newport. This is kind of ground zero for that phenomenon. The people who were originating the loans got paid to originate, not to make good loans that got paid back. Over and over again, you see folks in that position where to put the loan on does not mean to be there when the consequences of putting it on are felt. And that has to be an absolute condition precedent for involvement in any of this stuff. And though it is not, of course, sufficient for a positive outcome, but it is a condition precedent. To further bifurcate that issue into two big risks that we see, I would point one to moral hazard. Every single type of idiosyncratic credit is episodically uninteresting. Unfortunately, the vast majority of the people who are doing various forms of it are incentivized in every way possible to never acknowledge that that's the case. And so, like the proverbial dog with an unlimited supply of Alpo, they will only stop eating when their stomach explodes. Or to use a different analogy, when you give a guy a hammer and say the only way you can eat is to find nails, magically, he will find those nails, no matter how tight the risk reward of that next nail that comes along is. I think that moral hazard issue is a particularly dangerous one when you're talking about the alternatives business and the asset management business generally, because, as I'm sure you all know, allocators like to do the allocating. They don't like to be the person who says, well, here's the money, you find where it is. Find where the good stuff is and avoid the bad stuff. And so they create mandates that are very tight. And there's good intentions in the creation of those mandates, but there's moral hazard built into those mandates. And unfortunately, in a world where credit or capital finds opportunity as fast as it has ever done so, creating narrow mandated credit strategies is like trying to call the plays in a football game from the top row when you should be down on the field right behind the center. It's just very difficult and fraught with problems. The other key issue that dovetails with the risk in private credit generally is what we just call the lightning strike risk, which is that, as I mentioned, none of these things is going to make four times your money and bail you out. And so there are a lot of investment management products that feature this credit that are set up in such a way from a business perspective that insufficient diversity is able to be had in a given portfolio such that any one thing can bust a particular portfolio. And if there's one thing that is for sure, no matter who you are, no matter how good you are, no matter how much work you've done, no matter how great the reference checks are, things happen in these things. And the only way to mitigate that things happen risk is through diversity. And so the question then is, is there a business that you're investing in that has sufficient resources, has sufficient scale, is not mandate constricted, but can get the level of diversity necessary to get rid of that problem whereby that, you know, that one investment busts it? There's a brand name, large-scale credit firm that I know of. They had one of these very large credit investments in one particular thing. This was almost 20 years ago now. And this is a household name. And it happened to be that one was a fraud. And when I was at a different firm, and basically we had on the table terms to lend them money, even though they were the credit specialist, in a way such that if that fraud, you know, was what we all thought it was, we would end up basically taking over their entire enterprise. And so when you're the lender of last resort, the last thing you want to be is the borrower of a lender of the last resort. So that's the good news. From here, the question is, what are the short and medium term opportunities? And I think there's a lot. I would keep in mind here that a couple of things before we go into it. One is the notion of the haves and have-nots in credit. As investment management firms gain scale, as people are run toward brand, ultimately the sheer size of what needs to be put out is basically a tail that wags the dog of what the things that are invested in is. And so we have a situation where the regular way corporate real estate, structured finance, or consumer asset that can be a place where some big smart branded guy can put $100 million gets to borrow really, really cheap, really, really long, at really, really, you know, easy terms. But that gangly, weird, small thing that takes a lot of work really kind of can't get arrested. And we want to be in a position where we've created an enterprise where we can systematically go at very large numbers of those have-nots and get paid not because we're willing to be more junior, take more risk, price more tight, but because we're willing to deal with a non-value process risk or whatever that might be. The second part is this notion of cycle of life. You know, in some ways, collateral within credit is like one of these National Geographic things where, you know, someone's got to be the eater and someone's got to be the eaten. And there's no value judgment. There's nothing normative. It just has to be. And so when we think about different investment products and different places within credit, we think about the cycle of life. And in every given collateral type, there are places where you want to be and places where you don't want to be. It's not that you can just hate subprime auto. There's a lot of things that are bad, but there are a lot of aspects of what's in that, as an example, that are good, and we'll talk about that. So to start, corporate credit. Unfortunately, corporate credit is the easiest place to go when you are a head of an investment office with an investment committee that's saying, I read about this private credit thing. It's really great. We got to have some. What's wrong with you? That corporate credit means middle market lending, middle market corporate lending typically to private equity firms. As we've talked about, there's a huge amount of private equity available. In fact, there's $2.5 trillion of unspent private equity capital. Unfortunately, for the various theses people put out around the quote-unquote banks not doing it, this is one of the things the banks have not stopped doing and continue to do and involve themselves in all the time, unfortunately, for the thesis of why this is such a fabulous asset. And so from our perspective, when we see a corporate credit opportunity, our first question is, why won't a BDC or middle market lender do this? Because if they will, we have no interest. And so therefore, we need something different. We need a tough industry like energy, a tough guy, a tough process, a perceived but not real regulatory issue, a non-pretty sponsor, someone with a little bit of a wrinkle, or something with a little bit of a wrinkle. There's no wrinkle, there's no opportunity, we can't charge a premium. And so, you know, when you look at a typical BDC, you know, and it's publicly available, you know, lending to 5.5 times cash flow, 5 years, half first lien, half not, you know, 8-9%. You know, we have a portfolio that's, you know, 3.3 in our corporates and making 14% in almost all first. Why is that? Because there's always a wrinkle. Got to be a wrinkle. And we spend a lot of time in the energy. The medium-term opportunity, of course, talking going to the cycle of life, is all of the things I just named. I think we are going to have an absolute explosion of bad private credit, corporate credit to buy. And it'll be, for some of you with some gray hair, you may remember there was this notion of an ABL fund in 06, and there were all these kind of new fancy guys doing ABL for in hedge fund structures, and it's going to be great, and they all blew up. for credit quality reasons, for compliance reasons, for asset liability mismatching reasons, for credit crisis related reasons, all kinds of reasons, but it was ugly. I think that's a fraction of what is coming in the middle market corporate lending space. If someone pays 9 times for a 6 times asset, and I lend them 5.5 times, my loan to value is 5.5 divided by 6, not 5.5 divided by 9, no matter how many times I tell myself the latter. That fundamental issue will be the cause of the conflagration to come in that marketplace. Real estate credit is a bit of an analog. Anything that can fit inside a warehouse that's going to go to a CMBS ultimately has the issue that we talked about, where there's a disconnect between the assumption of credit risk and the realization of its consequences. And so it feels good to look at a net income producing, NOI producing, relatively straightforward, office building and lend it at 65% loan to value. But when rates back up, cap rates come up, the NOI goes down because of what's going on in the world, and you are the person who was paid 5% for owning that risk, it's not going to feel good. And that goes to that have and have not problem, where these assets that feel good, they seem like the highest quality stuff, because they are so wildly crowded with capital, they in fact, on a risk-adjusted basis, are the scariest stuff frequently. And the stuff that looks gangly and ugly and scary and weird and have-naughty tends to be the stuff where on a risk-adjusted basis, based on what you can charge, because no one else wants it, is actually less risky. So on the real estate credit side, we're buying, we're looking at, mall repositionings and land in kind of infill areas. As an example, we have a business in Florida where if you are a U.S. citizen, you can borrow for a single family home at 80% at 4% for 30 years, but if you're not, you can't borrow anything. So we'll lend you money at 12% for 2 years at 55% loan to value, such that if we go back to 08 pricing, we're still covered. And by the way, once we get a pool of that, then we can borrow from a bank at 50% of our price at 5%. So we need to find those wrinkles again on the real estate side. And there's always a real estate guy whose eyes are bigger than his stomach, so there's always going to be stuff to do. It's just a question of how much. I would say structured finance, and more broadly, C&I, structured and consumer, is really where we spend a relatively disproportionate amount of our time. In this area, the banks really did go away, and they're really not coming back. When you talk about the capital attribution necessary from the perspective of either the U.S. banking regulator rules or the international Basel rules, this stuff can't get done. And we find large numbers of have-nots occupying those spaces, whether it's in C&I and aviation finance and entertainment finance and construction factoring and litigation finance, large amounts of very asset-covered stuff, very low correlation to the overall world, all kinds of reasons why if you're a BDC, you can't do it, all kinds of reasons why if you're a mega firm, you can't put $100 million into it, but fabulous risk-reward where we can really kind of create real value. Structured finance, the same type of thing, where there are places within leasing and logistics finance and trade finance where, interestingly, you can get first lien regular way bank participants or securitization markets to behave, basically to lend really, really cheaply while you yourself are lending really, really expensive. And we see that a lot and like it a lot. And then consumer assets, from residential mortgages to subprime auto to charge-off credit to student loans, there's just a whole world out there of really ugly things that have only begun to show themselves. Lastly, I'd point out also, this is mostly about North America. We could talk on a country-by-country basis around the world. There are plenty of places where fundamentally that are not in capital's emerging markets, but that are not North America, where there's lots of interesting and good stuff to do, and we're spending time in those places also. So I think there's a lot of risk. There's a lot of things to pay attention to. When done right, private credit can really be orthogonal to relatively conventional alternative investment management portfolios or institutional or endowment portfolios. But as one of the prior panelists said, it takes a ton of work. You got to know where the bodies are buried, but there's a lot to do. Any questions?
Let's see. How about senior secured corporate debt?
Yep.
That. And then I was a little concerned about the BDC. Are you saying if you're investing through a BDC, that's a little safer, or are you wrapping that in too? So those two things.
Yeah. So BDCs are just a way that people do privately negotiated middle market corporate lending. You could also do it through a fund structure. It doesn't really matter, other than the fact that you do it typically through a stock, although there are private BDCs. But fundamentally, middle market corporate credit is really, really overbought. And so senior secured bank loans, which are kind of a subset of that, typically when people say that, they mean bigger credits, and they mean less middle marketing. Let's say when people talk about the bank loan market, they're talking about, you know, facilities of a quarter of a billion to a billion or more. I think the answer there is your risk for principal loss is not great. Your risk to market is great. I think you're at a time when, if you look at the issuance numbers, anyone who could conceivably borrow in that market is doing so because they think it's really, really cheap and really, really easy. And I think a lot of the problems have been hidden by the fact that you have the virtuous circle of refinancings bailing people out of their issues. When that all unwinds itself, there can be significant downside. To put a number on that, when you look at, as an example, go back to 98 or 01, 02, there's a measure that was more in use called the LCDX, which basically was an index of leveraged loan or bank debt pricing. And that went typically down to about 60 cents on the dollar. So what happened in very simple terms was, at the peak of the bank loan market, on average you were getting 5+ times debt to cash flow, and at the trough you were at 3 times. Now, why does 3 times kind of tend to be relatively looked at as a base? Well, because logically, at that point, within 3 years, you're literally cash flowing your entire bait back, right? So at some point, it starts to get, you know, so cheap that you just got to own it. That said, I think in the wake of the WorldCom crisis, I bought debt at 0.6 times cash flow of big real enterprises, or U.S. West, one of the regional local exchange carriers, at 1.3 times cash flow. So the degree to which this stuff can go down, you know, is I would say systematically underestimated. And I think very few of the people who are actually at the trigger of large-scale portfolios doing this were senior and in that same type of seat when those uglier things happened in prior times. So it seems hard to believe that it could be possible. But, you know, in August of 98, in the wake of the Thai baht crisis, there was more liquidity there than there is now in the OTC markets, and there wasn't a trade between August and December. So I'd be cautious.
I'm kind of hoping they're going to serve scotch with lunch after that. I heard Ray Dalio say the other day in his normal charming way, this is another one of those. Sort of alluding to the concept that financial history repeats itself. So,
yes.
You know, we're seeing subprime, we're seeing synthetic, you know, assets out there called bespoke investments or whatever they're calling them. I mean, is this another one of those? I mean, is it so fractious right now that we could see a massive crisis, or is this one that, because of the diversity of the funding sources across all these different asset classes, that it'll be buffered by the, you know, that it won't draw down the banks, it won't draw down the entire real estate market? I mean, what's your perspective on that?
Well, the sheer volume of just paper to be owned has never been bigger. And anybody in these markets, in the tradable markets, has benefited from the central banks of the developed countries just buying and doing more buying for now almost a decade. So it's very hard when you have that systematic macro put combined with the absolute obliteration of the OTC market making capabilities out there that were caused by the regulators, it's incredibly hard to know where the bottom of the pool is, I think. So I would agree with them. Any other questions? Sure. Well, thank you for having me.